This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us Margaret Rozga from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She is a University of Wisconsin Waukesha Professor of English Emerita, and she creates poetry from her ongoing concern for social justice issues. Her book, 200 Nights in One Day, tells the story of this Milwaukee Fair housing struggle. The book was awarded a bronze medal in poetry in the 2009 Independent Publishers Book Awards and named an outstanding achievement in poetry for 2009 by the Wisconsin Library Association. Rozga is also the author of Though I Haven't Been to Baghdad, a Wisconsin Library Association outstanding achievement in 2012, and the book Justice, Freedom, Herbs. Her newly published Pestiferous Questions, A Life in Poems, was written with the help of the Creative Writers Fellowship at the American Antiquarian Society. It has received glowing reviews in the fall 2017 issue of Wisconsin People and Ideas. She writes monthly columns for Milwaukee Neighborhood News and for the Los Angeles Art News. Welcome to the program, Margaret.
Thank you so much, Sheila. I'm really glad to be here.
I am really glad to be able to talk to you out there in Milwaukee. The fact that you write political poetry has always intrigued me because I have learned so often from professors that I studied with that poetry can't be political, that when we write politically, we border on propaganda or ranting. And it's a real feat to me that your gorgeous poems are political and do foster progressive issues. So I was wondering if we could open the program by having you talk a little bit about how that works for you. I'd like to know your thoughts on how literary work can be political without becoming rants or propaganda.
I think the best way that I can talk about that is to refer to a poem by another poet, Kristen Latour, a friend of mine who lives in the Chicago area. She has a poem that I frequently use in workshops that get the idea across. I think for reference to current events, political issues, to work in a poem, they have to come from some place where the poet is. And Kristen does this in a poem called Today I Imagine I'm in Belgium. And the poem situates her in a coffee shop in Chicago, hearing the news or reading the news. The news is a lot of violence going on. There's 19 people killed in Chicago and some woman recovering from gunshot wounds in Colorado. But she reads it, she takes in this news, imagining she's in Belgium, and imagining that while she's having coffee and croissants in Belgium, she's reading the U.S. And so that gives her some distance, and it's a way of saying the whole world isn't as violent as our country is, without having to say that. So she talks about the almond paste in a piece of bakery, and she talks about the flavor of her coffee, and she has all these sensory images that keep the poem grounded in where she is, and I just think it works really well. So how do politics enter into your life? Where are you that you hear about it? What are you doing? What are the objects around you? What are the smells? What are the tastes? So keeping it grounded in what's close at hand seems to me to be important.
So I think what you're saying, too, is that all poets are trying to capture their experience of a moment or of the moment of an insight. And for you, politics is very much a part of that, your political surroundings and the ways in which they affect you and the people around you?
Yes. Actually, I was the moderator at a book festival recently where the session was on poets responding to nature, and two of them had quite different approaches. One of them was looking at natural scenes, walking the beach and so on, as comfort, a source of comfort to her. The other one was writing about the BP oil spill. And in the discussion that followed, it became clear that the one writing about the BP oil spill was not really doing something essentially different from the person writing about her walk along the beach finding comfort, although she wasn't finding comfort in the BP oil spill, but she was doing observation. It's just that they were observing different things.
So that's a really important point. What we observe is the content of our poetry.
Definitely. I really believe that a poet is a seer. And I don't mean that in any kind of prophetic sense. I mean it just literally aware of what is around you, taking in through eyes, ears, nose.
Mm. So you have published 4 books?
I have.
And I was thinking that we might talk about them in chronological order, and perhaps you could read from them as we talk about them. So Which was the first book that you published?
The first one was 200 Nights in One Day. It's a series of poems from the points of view of about a half dozen different people who were involved in the 1967-68 marches for open housing in Milwaukee.
What was the inspiration for the book, and for you personally, besides the fact that it was going on in your hometown?
It was written 40 years after the fact, and sometimes I ask myself, why did it take me so long to be able to talk about what was a life-changing series of events for me? And there's lots of factors that enter into the answer to that, but a few years before the book appeared, I started to write a memoir, and it wasn't going well. The campus at which I was teaching has a campus read program, and one year the campus read was about race and racism. The theater director always did a play that was connected to the campus read. So he was looking for a play that was about race and racism and came up to me and said, "You write the play." He knew I was writing this memoir. I think he knew that it wasn't going well. It solved the problem for him if I would do it. It may solve a problem for me that looking at the series of events in a different form would make it work. It was such a crazy challenge that, of course, I said yes. Other people who had been involved in the marches wanted to help me. So we had a gathering, and they told me what they remembered, their stories. I went home, and the next morning I woke up, and I could hear their voices in my head. So without getting dressed, without eating breakfast, I sat down at my computer and started to type what I remembered them saying. And that was the start of the play. The play was largely a series of monologues. And after the play, which ended up having 4 full productions, I thought, I have all this material now. It's in the voice of people who were active, almost like poems. If I turned it into poems, I could do it, and I wouldn't need a director and a venue and tickets and all of the actors, which gets to be pricey. And I turned it from the format of the play into poems in something of a rush. Felt like I had to get this done, so I was working on it really intently. Then a poet friend of mine said, "I think I know a publisher who's looking for something like your play. Here's his contact information. See if he'd be interested." And so I met with the publisher, Leroy Chappelle from Bennu Press. He wasn't interested in the play, but by this time I had the poems, and I brought it along to the meeting, and I said, "Well, maybe you'll like it in this form." And he called me the next day, and he said, "I want to publish this book."
Oh, that's a very, very wonderful situation for you. Can you tell us how you got the title for the volume of poems?
The open housing campaign in Milwaukee had 200 consecutive nights of marching for this legislation. So the 200 nights seemed just to describe why this kept on going and why the poems covered close to a year in time. And then the one day came to me because I thought, it's not over. There were 200 nights of marching, and one day we may have something like racial equality.
I see. Could you read to us the poem you selected from that book?
I'd love to. This is a poem I often use when I'm talking to student groups. Some lines that are in italics, which are the lines of Norma Britton, who was one of the people who brought the issue to the fore. She and her husband, Ronald, the Vietnam veteran, just returned, were looking to rent a flat. And they, well, you'll see in the poem.
Okay.
But anyway, what I do with student groups is have somebody volunteer to be Norma and read her part, and that gets little audience participation going, which helps to connect the audience to the situation. Anyway, the poem is called R-E-S-P-E-C-T, Ronald and Norma Britton, December 1966. It was a well-built brick house, but Norma seemed uneasy. She checked and rechecked the address. Okay, she says, but I wonder why there's no for rent sign up here. Oh, what worried her now? I survived Vietnam. Our daughter is healthy, 10 pounds already. We have money for rent. We'll be able to save for a down payment. Doesn't look like any Negroes on the block. Hey, Norma, it's winter. Folks are inside. We have laws now. Martin Luther King. Norma, I've fought for my country. Things have changed. Right. She smiles. I walk around the car, give her a hand, help her with the baby. A white woman answers the door. We'd like to see the flat you advertised for rent. Yes, the downstairs unit. Rent it? Already? It was in this afternoon's paper. You say, what? You couldn't cancel the ad that quick? You're worried about what? About what would your neighbors think? Norma and I look at each other, at our daughter, at the door closing.
If you just joined us on KPTZ 91.9 FM Port Townsend, you are listening to In Conversation, discussions on writing and the writing life with Sheila Bender. Today, Sheila is talking with Milwaukee poet Margaret Rozga about her body of work, weaving the personal with community activism.
Margaret, it's beautiful, and I can really see your point about how poetry can be political and deeply human, and also how writing the play and listening to the voices of the people of those times really is embedded in the poetry. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
The next book's title is...
Though I Haven't Been to Baghdad.
Right. Maybe you could tell us where that title comes from and then read a poem from it.
Shortly after my son graduated from high school, he signed up to be an Army reservist, somewhat against my will, I might add. Shortly after he signed up, he was activated and was sent to Iraq. I was terribly worried about him, and I was determined to face head-on what was going on, not to dodge the reality, the likelihood of his being injured. It's still hard for me to say that. And what I found was I was in this strange sort of mental state where I could talk about things without feeling anything. So I sort of divorced my emotional reactions from the intellectual perception. So the book has a lot of sentence fragments in it. I would go so far to facing what was going on, and then I would just stop. I didn't want to tell Matthew's story. I wanted this to be my reactions to his deployment. So I hadn't been to Baghdad. The poem that I want to read is an example of having that fragmented sort of thinking. I also couldn't write about it in the first person, so it becomes the son and the mother, third person. This poem is The Son. The son parks his pickup in the mother's garage, stays only long enough to... She turns the pancakes, warms maple. He leaves his fishing rods in the basement, tagged with the names of friends in case he doesn't. When he walks through the garage into the falling sun, the mother wonders, will she ever... Will he...
Margaret, I have tears listening to that. We often talk about the white space in poems, the unsaid. You've used it brilliantly to make us all understand what that kind of parting is like. I find that technique hugely successful. Chills me. So, is the whole book written in the third person?
There might be a poem or two toward the end where I use first person. For sure there is one where I'm not writing about him. I'm writing thinking about the world, the state of the world. toward the end of the book, I start to use first person.
So would it be correct to say then that by writing, don't know that the poems are in a chronological order that you wrote them in, but did you feel some sort of ability towards the end of writing these poems to actually use I and to put yourself out there?
Right, I think I did. And partly that was the writing helped me to reach that point, and partly it was the distance in time.
So even though we're talking about poetry, that poem brings up, I'm sure in other listeners too, the question, how did he fare?
He was injured in a truck bomb attack at Police Academy in Mosul. I sometimes wonder today what he thinks as he watches newsreels about Mosul. But getting back to then, he told me I didn't have to worry about him, that he would always be with Sergeant Martin, his mentor, in the unit that he was in. In the truck bomb attack that day, Sergeant Martin and another leader of the unit, Sergeant Kaiser, heard an explosion in the distance, and they ran up the outside staircase to the roof of the police academy. And there was a truck barreling down the road toward the police academy, and they opened fire on the truck. Matthew was 10 seconds or so behind them going up the stairs. By the time he reached the roof, the biggest explosion at the police academy occurred. He was thrown back and got a concussion and had his eardrums blown out by the noise of the explosion. He carried Sergeant Martin down from the roof of the police academy. So his injuries were not life-threatening. They were not incapacitating. There certainly was an emotional toll when this person who had been so helpful to him dies. So there's a lot in the book about hearing problems.
Right. So we have only a limited amount of time, and I want to be sure that we talk about and hear from the poems in the other two books, especially the most recent book. So your third book's title is...
Justice, Freedom, Herbs.
Lovely on the herbs. Can you tell us a little bit about it and read a poem, please?
Let me read the poem that explains the title. The Justice, Freedom, Herbs were antique garden markers that I put in my garden mostly to keep the person who lives upstairs from me from cutting down. He did the lawn, and he would just mow right over. So anyway, the poem is called Eden. I know what it's like. One year, Dad grafted branches from five different apple varieties onto a single trunk. The next spring, he set his camera for time-lapse photos, blossoms in motion. In a succession of summers, peach seedlings from stones Mom buried sprouted, thrived, defied the cut of Mr. Stanish's lawnmower and set forth fruit we carried to all the neighbors. I long for a garden as abundant as Mom's, perfect as Dad's. Imagine my own tiny plot with more than perennial chives and hearty mint. I add pepper plants, hot and sweet. Ask myself, how much room can parsley take? And what about piney rosemary? Surely space still for a single heirloom tomato seedling. Among the plants, I set an antique marker, herbs. For Mother's Day, my children give me two more, justice, freedom. Before anything blossoms, before it even blushes, before green springs tall, plumps up, out, full beyond promise, I dream, no, I taste perfect fruit.
Thank you. Especially in these times, wouldn't it be nice if we could taste perfect fruit and have a progressive government?
Then as the garden grew, and I wrote looking out the window at the little garden plot, what was happening with the garden became symbolic. In August, freedom is covered in basil, herbs are overwhelmed by the tomato growing far beyond its cage, and justice is barely visible.
So if you had to talk about the message of that book, how would you say that?
I think it is how things grow. This was written mostly during what's called the Wisconsin Uprising, when the governor of Wisconsin was doing away with unions for government workers and then for a right to work, and then was going toward a right to work state and taking away other things from teachers. So the movement was growing at the same time the garden was growing, and they became metaphors for each other. I often am in conversations where people express despair, what are we going to do, or cynicism, nothing does any good. And I don't believe that. I think we have to keep trying. Tiny seeds open up and push their way through the ground. That's the way I see social justice movements overcoming odds. And
have things kind of culminated in your most recent book, Pestiferous Questions?
In Pestiferous Questions, I take a step back in history. I talk about a much earlier period, and partially I was first interested in a personal relationship question. I happened to pick up a collection of the letters of Jesse Benton Fremont, who was born in 1824, died in 1902. She's usually identified in terms of the men in her life. Her father was a senator from Missouri. Her husband was an explorer, John Charles Fremont. And I picked up this book of her letters and happened to open it to one where she's writing to her husband saying that she would write a short bio to accompany the publication of his travel notes, his exploration, which became a bestseller, the equivalent of a bestseller in the time. She would write the bio to go with the book, but she didn't know when he was born. She didn't know how old he was. This is when they're married 5 years. How could she not know how old he was? I was first interested in her to figure out what was going on with their relationship. What kept me interested was the fact that her life intertwines with all the significant issues of her time, especially in the period, the run-up to the Civil War, the 1850s. Fremont was the first Republican candidate for president in 1856, before Abraham Lincoln. She's in a politically powerful position through the influence of her father and her husband and her own vivacious nature. So that kept me interested. I didn't really know, I didn't think, how to write from this history that I was not part of. And so it was the challenge of finding that out.
Before you read to us, can you give us a definition of pestiferous?
Yes. That's always one of the first questions I get when I talk about the book. It's related to the word pestilence, so something unpleasant with the connotation of being diseased. It was the phrase that her father used to talk about the expansion of slavery. It was a pestiferous question. It came up all the time. He was a Western expansionist. In fact, he favored admitting Oregon, organizing a territorial government for Oregon as early as 1818. Congress wasn't interested because that would have meant adding a free state and upsetting the balance of power between free states and slave states and Congress. So Oregon, and including Washington, because that was part of the same territory, could have been British, could have been another country.
Interesting. Can we hear one of the poems, especially one that is pestiferous?
There is one here. How about this one? Jesse, the fifth expedition. Her husband goes on 5 expeditions exploring the West. So this is on his Jesse during the fifth expedition, 1853. 4 months, no word from Mr. Fremont. Father, cold, unsympathetic. He talks Kansas, only Kansas, the territory divided obliquely as the rivers flow, southeast from northwest, Kansas, Kansas, 3 times Kansas. He talks a mid-continent path for the railroad, our Pacific ports. We must expand. He lost his Senate seat, his House seat, still talking expansion westward, what he dare not say without expanding slavery. Father, they don't listen. They won't listen. You argued statehood the 30 years they ignored Oregon, let British claims manifestly linger. Now they want territory, only because it is Southern, only because they want slaves.
Hmm. You have proven to us, Margaret, that poetry can be deeply personal, deeply felt, and political. And you've proven to me that there's a pressing need for more poetry of this kind. So I'm wondering, before we end, if you might have a little piece of advice for upcoming poets or practicing poets about how they might take in the political climate and world and write as compellingly as you do.
Well, thank you for your kind words about my poems. Maybe I can talk about a current project I'm working on, and as a kind of a prompt. We're working to create a poetry chapbook anthology for the 50th anniversary of the open housing marches. That's forward-looking. That's, what is it that we want? Where is it that we want to go? And especially in terms of housing, where do we want to live? So if you think about where you live now and what you like best about it, and then imagine the community that we need, the place where there would be racial equality and social justice, what would that look like? What of your old neighborhood would be there? What else would be there? And you can use that, where I want to live or where we want to live, as a refrain line, as a repeat line, beginning sentences and lines and then building from there with concrete specific details.
Thank you, Margaret. We're going to have to end now, which I'm sorry to have to do. I know that our community here in Port Townsend will really enjoy listening to your work and your prompt idea here and be inspired to write in a political vein, but that's also, again, compelling and personal and full of the angst that we humans have when things are not going peacefully and rightfully. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheila.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.